Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Good show in store for you today. We welcome back renowned astronomer Bob Berman. Bob is the author of countless books and articles on astronomical-related things. He is also the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. He's a world traveler. He is constantly going on these tours where they go up and look in the sky, and he's back from one now. Nice to have you here, Mr. Berman.
Great being back, Ray. Thank you.
The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Now, you can also post comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Or you can tweet your questions for Bob at WAMC Vox Pop. So, it's the equinox, Bob.
It is the equinox.
That's a great, it's a great day.
It is a great day, yes. A lot of things are real, and there's one that's made up.
What do you mean?
What's real today is that today's the day that the North and the South Pole are sideways to the sun. Neither of them tilts sunward. It's the day that the sun rises and sets due east and due west. It's the day that the sun moves like a laser beam, straight line across the sky. Doesn't do that in the winter. The winter has a curved path that's concave toward the left or toward the south. Summer, curved path through the sky that's concave toward the right or towards the north. Not today. Sun moves it, if you took a time exposure, ruler straight line across the sky. So all, and 12 hours of day, 12 hours of night, actually a little more sun than darkness just because of refraction that bends the sun's image up when it's low. But essentially, the world shares 12 and 12. Those are the real things. What's made up is that we choose this day to call it the start of spring.
All right. Well, obviously, it doesn't feel like that at this moment.
Not today.
You know, but why for thousands of years has there been this importance? I mean, they discovered this a long, long time ago, and it's been very important for many, many cultures.
Sure.
I wonder why.
Well, this is the halfway point between when the sun rises at its extreme rightmost point on one solstice and extreme leftmost point on the other. And this is the midpoint of that. So that's another reason we have the equal in equinox. Mm. So it's a period of balance. And it doesn't last long because this is when days are increasing their length fastest and nights are retreating the fastest. So it's almost as if the heavens and earth are poised, balanced, and temporarily motionless before rushing headlong onto the northern summer.
Okay, now explain to me quickly,
it's
because
poetic.
We have to get to the, you know, that was pretty good. Don't be too impressed with yourself. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Explain to me why, that you said something that never struck me before, that the days get longer quicker. I thought it would be a constant sort of pace.
No, it's like a sine wave. If you traced it, it really looks like a sine wave or oscilloscope pattern where the days hardly increase once you've reached the winter solstice, December 21st, and you listen to, well, it used to be Mike Landon, who is the newer fellow.
Paul Caiano.
Paul Caiano, and he'll say there's 1 minute more of sunlight, 1 minute more of sunlight. That continues for weeks, and then it becomes 2 minutes, and now it's 3 minutes. But another month and a half, it'll go back to two and then one. Because since we are sideways to the sun and we're changing, we're moving in our orbit, the amount of where the shadow line falls most rapidly moves into the north and retreats from the south. Whereas when we're most pointed toward the sun, let's say on June 21st, there's not much difference in how much we're pointed the day before the day after. So the time doesn't really change rapidly then.
I see. All right, let's go to the phones. Bob Berman is our guest. Always great to have Bob here.
And it's always great to have you because you're picturing these things that are not easy to visualize. You're really visualizing them.
Well, I'm trying to picture them. It's not necessarily always successful. I want to ask you about your trip to Alaska in a minute, but let's since I've opened the lines, let's go to Eleanor in Newburgh. You're on.
Thank you, Mr. Berman. I have two quotes about stars, and I wonder if there's any scientific evidence to support these. They're both poetry. The first one is from the book of Job. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? The second is a poem from the hymn book. This is my father's world, and to my listening ears, All nature sings and round me rings the music of the spheres. Is there music in the stars? Uh-huh. I just wondered.
All right.
Well, it'd be nice to say there was. Space, of course, is a vacuum, so it's perfectly silent. Music of the spheres, there have been composers, most famous Holst, who made the famous composition, The Planets. But if you listen to his compositions of Mercury and Venus and the various other planets, you'll find them rather dreary and structured. Personally, I find unstructured electronic or meditation-type music to better capture the free-flowing spirit of nature. That having been said, there's a fellow called Elliot Rodgers in Britain who just a few days ago sent me what he called a mathematical proof that the planetary speeds march in the same ratio as the diatonic musical scale. And they differ from
each
other.
There you go, Eleanor. There's an answer.
So perhaps there is some basis for it after all.
All right. Well, that's a great way to start the show. And, you know, it seems to me you say you prefer this sort of free music. But is not the universe based on a strict series of laws, even if we don't know what they all are? I mean, shouldn't it be regimented?
Well, it's true. But there's an old human fascination with trying to make earthly things, whether it's geometrical shapes, you know, round or square or dodecahedrons, match up with the universe, or make small things match up with larger things. You've heard people say that electrons going around an atom's nucleus is analogous to a solar system where you have a sun and planets going around it. And we always try to make associations, but they, to my mind, they almost always fail. For example, atoms are 10,000 times emptier than solar systems. Musical notes don't really match up the spacing between the planets. You really have to search, as this fellow did, and finding mean orbital velocities, and even then it didn't work unless he used perihelion velocities, and that's sort of fishing for data.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like we're trying to grasp the universe in our hands, and Ray, it's like trying to grasp water or sand. Generally, except for the language of math, which really does seem to be the language of the universe, it falls through our fingers, and our intellectual minds don't really do a great job of making these associations between heaven and earth.
All right, well, before we get to the break, and then we'll start taking calls in earnest, you've been to Alaska. You went to look for what?
My tour group, Berman Astronomy Tours, brought 46 people, as we do every year, to Alaska. I've done it 6 years. I don't get paid a dime, so I feel like I can mention it.
All right, well, go ahead.
And the purpose is to, of course, see the sights, fly around Mount McKinley, do a lot of cool things. But we really are there for the aurora, and we have our secret place where we go, where we usually see the aurora without fail. This time it was a close call because it took until the third night to see one, and the fourth night before we saw a great one. But when the group sees it, let out a sigh of relief.
We got them there. No refunds had to be given.
They saw it, and everybody oohed and awed. And the aurora is, you know, one of the top three celestial spectacles. There are three. They don't need a telescope.
Okay. A solar eclipse, right?
Right. Total solar eclipse. I put the aurora second, a good display of the aurora, and a great comet third.
Yeah. And now, speaking of comets, kind of a letdown here with the one that's passing by.
Comet Pan-STARRS, and I looked for it with binoculars. I knew exactly where to look for it. It was a piece of garbage.
Oh, well, now, wait a minute.
I mean, it could be photographed. If you pointed a camera at the right place, it turned out to be a little tiny little streak, and it showed up with long exposure photography, but it wasn't the breathtaking comet that we're expecting Comet Ison to be this November. Now, that's another
You could be
story.
Wrong, though, right? It depends on how much the sun tears away.
Comets are like cats. They do exactly as they please.
Okay. But so this one, I saw a lovely picture, I think taken in New Mexico or Arizona, of this comet that you have poo-pooed now for the world. And it looked great. I mean, I don't know.
It looked great, but if you were using binoculars and looking at the right places, I've been doing, and I did it up from 30,000 feet with a great window from where the sky was black. I did it from Alaska from a dark area. I was looking in the right place at the right time, and even with binoculars, it's hard to see a trace of it. And one of the readers of Astronomy Magazine sent me a photo he had taken, and he said, too, that the photo did not show what he saw. He could not see it.
Mm. So, you know, you have high hopes for the next one, and the next one's called?
Next one is Ison, and that's a different ball of wax.
Why?
Because it is huge. It's following the same path as a comet that amazed the world in the 1600s. And
is this the same comet that amazed the world in the 1600s?
No, but it could be another piece of the same parent body. And comet hunter Rob I'll get back to you.
Mr. X.
Brain freeze, yeah. Who's discovered more comets than anyone in the world, says that this one has glory written all over
really?
It.
Really? Oh, good. And so
Comet Ison.
They know that this one is actually much bigger than the...
Much bigger. It's just now inside the orbit of Jupiter. It's coming straight toward us, and this one should put on quite a show. We're taking a group down to Chile to see it, but honestly, if it survives its trip around the sun, it's just going to barely miss the sun. Yeah. And if it's not broken to pieces by that very close perihelion encounter, it should be fantastic the first week of December.
Low in the sky, high in the sky?
It'll be low in the sky at first, then by about December 7th, it'll be high enough to see readily. And if it's as bright as we think it'll be seen well even when it's low because the tail will push upward. But we're going down to try to grab it before it even reaches the sun to see it when it first appears.
When you know it'll be intact, at least.
Exactly.
So, I mean, in 1910, I guess, Halley's Comet, I mean, the pictures were a huge broom in the sky.
It was.
Will we ever see anything like that again?
Unfortunately, this was the wrong lifetime for Comet Halley. And by the way, most of the pictures from 1910 were of a second comet, the Great January Comet of that year, that most people mistook for Halley. It was brighter than Halley. It was though Halley was good that year. This time, 1985-86, we were on the wrong side of the sun.
Yeah.
Next time around, 2061, it should be the much better. Should be going across half the sky. And the time after that, in 2137, we're expecting the best visit in 2,000 years. We just had the wrong lifetime.
All right. Well, I mean, we'll try to hang in there. Hey, Zach, let's take a break. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Bob Berman, our guest. 800-348-2551. More calls coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from St. George's School, Clifton Park, New York, a private elementary school offering full-day academic programs to kindergarten and first-grade students, stgeorgeschoolcp.org. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Quarry and fabrication, rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires, used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. AshfieldStone.com. And Lucky Chocolates, Saugerties, New York. Organic and fair trade truffles and treats, seasonal chocolates, LuckyChocolates.com.
J.J. Johnson, my hero on Vox Pop. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is the guest. As often happens when Bob's here, we end up chatting, and then I leave you out of it. But now I'm going back to the phones. I swear to you, Don in Great Barrington. Don, you're on.
Hello, Ray.
Hello.
Dr. Berman.
Hi.
Morning on one of the finest, many finest features on the station, Writer's Almanac. Garrison Keillor said that today is the equinox, and it commemorates the alignment of Earth's axis with the center of the sun, which sounds way off to me, and it doesn't sound right. But I thought I'd just ask you for your opinion, and I can listen on the air, please.
You want to stay here?
I can.
Okay, Don.
Okay, no, you're absolutely right. It's not the Earth's axis aligned with the center of the sun. We're perpendicular to the sun, not pointed toward it. The only planet that can ever point to the sun is the planet Uranus, because it travels through space on its side, tipped about 90 degrees from the way it moves through space. But you're quite right. We're essentially perpendicular to the sun today.
All right. Thank you very much.
Don, Sure. Thanks a lot. Now, why does Uranus do that?
Maybe it got hit early on in its formation.
But it's gas, right?
Yeah, it's gas, but even gas can get hit, a ball of gas. Admittedly, that's strange. Most comets have a tilt that's something like ours. For example, we're tilted 23.5 degrees. Mars is tilted 24.5 degrees. Saturn is tilted 26.5 degrees. That seems to be the most popular tilt, if that's the right word. Jupiter is only 3.
All right.
Mercury has no tilt.
It's so close, though, right?
Yeah, but it's the only planet that goes around without the slightest seasons because it just has no tilt at all.
I mean, it's so close that perhaps it did at one time, and the gravity of the sun caused some
maybe tidal adjustments. Effects. That's it's odd. So the tilts are all over the place.
All right, let's go to Stephen and Rensselaer. Stephen, you're on with Bob Berman.
Yes, I'd like to ask you guys, and all the talk about manned space missions to Mars, it always seems to be a question that we just lack the will and the financial resources. But I read an article, I remember about 15 years ago in the New Yorker magazine, that's always stuck with me, in which somebody said that there's really a lot of questions whether the human body can survive a mission to Mars. Mm. And I think it was primarily in terms of exposure to radiation, and secondly, in terms of lack of gravitation. And I think, there was something about that the blood production, the bone marrow would be affected, and that there's a lot of questions on that point. People just assume, having watched Star Trek, the human being can survive in outer space, but this writer felt very differently, and I'd just like your guest thoughts on that.
Bob, you've talked about this very topic.
Yeah, and it's a very valid point. Shannon Lucid, in particular, who is America's most experienced woman astronaut in space, she spent over a year in space, in orbit, continues to express strong doubts that we'll ever be able to have a significant presence on Mars for the reasons that the caller just expressed. First of all, lower gravity isn't good for you. And it not just that it makes your face look puffy and it's not a place to go on a first date.
Nice.
And the hair gets all messed up. But it's you lose bone, and even if you exercise on the treadmill, as they're all doing, you come back with 15-20% bone density loss, which in most cases is irreversible. You never get that back when you're back on Earth.
Okay.
But more importantly is the radiation, as the caller brought up. We have a magnetosphere that helps, and an atmosphere that helps guard it. Mars has no atmosphere to speak of. It's only 1% as thick as ours, and no magnetosphere. So the radiation dose on Mars would be continuing. It's estimated that a two-year mission on Mars, and it has to be at least 2 years because that's how long it takes for Earth and Mars to realign, 26 months before you could send back the next craft and bring the people back.
Yeah.
And it's estimated that people on Mars would lose between 15-40% of their brain cells during that mission because of the ongoing radiation. Now, you could live in a shielded underground place, but what's the point? It's like going to Hawaii and staying in the lobby of the hotel. You know, you're not really exploring the planet then.
Yeah.
So is this good for you? No, it'd be really bad for you. And my feeling is that the first person who dies of an early cancer or who dies because they can't get medical attention. Remember that woman in Antarctica a few years ago who she had breast cancer and there was no way to get her out. She was a doctor herself, so she knew what was going on. And there's no way to get her out. And that was Antarctica. Now, on Mars, no CAT scans, no surgeons, so the first time we lose a few people and makes all the news.
Yeah.
I wonder if the public is still going to be excited about funding continued visits to Mars. It would be the most dangerous thing we've ever done. And the caller is absolutely right. It's never discussed.
Stephen, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go over to Tim in Guilderland. Tim, you're on. Hello. Going once, Mr. Tim. Ay, caramba. Let's go over to Reed in Rensselaer. Reed, you're on.
Yes. Yes, okay. I'm not sure if I talked to Dr. Berman or not a year ago about analemmas, and I wasn't satisfied. But what the gentleman said from Great Barrington about the axis of the Earth finally becoming in line with a vertical axis in the sun, that being the equinox, right?
Yes, neither pole is tilted toward the sun today.
Yeah. Okay. Well, right now we would be parallel. Okay, but speaking of the winter and the summer.
But let's make you happy about the equinox. You said you talked about it and you weren't satisfied. We want you to be satisfied. So let's get back into that and let me give you a satisfying answer.
Okay. Oh, this is good.
Yes.
He's thinking of one, I think.
But what I want to suggest is that when we are to the left or to the right, when the Earth is literally to the left or to the right of that point on December 21st, that would be the reason for the unequal sunsets and sunrises. Would that not be true?
No. I mean, you're phrasing, you say, would that not be true? So I have to think twice about whether a yes or a no works there.
Okay, I'm sorry. Isn't it true that we have unequal sunset sunrises around the equinoxes because we're to the left or to the right physically to when the axes align?
Here's the reason for the equinox. Because of two factors produces this analemma. Now, for the and you're right, the analemma is has to do with the time versus the whether it's on the solstice or not. And as we pointed out last time, the earliest sunset is not on the day of the equinox, December 21st, but the earliest sunset, we get the earliest sunset around Pearl Harbor Day on December 7th, full 2 weeks earlier. And we get the latest sunrise in early January. So they do not match that time. And the question is why. And the equinox answers the question. The analemma answers the question. The analemma is simply, and I know you know this, but let me explain this to our listeners. Yeah. If you were to plot or take a time exposure of the sun at the same time per day, let's say 12 noon, and you compensated for daylight saving time, what you'd find is a figure 8 in the sky, an unequal 8, where one lobe is larger than the other lobe, but it still looks like an 8. And that shows the sun's position at the same time each day. Now, it's not a straight line. Of course, you understand a straight line because the sun is higher in the summer and lower in the winter. That accounts for the vertical axis. But what about that horizontal bit that produces the 8, the thickness of the 8? That happens for two purposes. One, we have a elliptical orbit, which means we speed up and slow down, and yet our clocks don't speed up and slow down. We've got 86,400 seconds in every day. That never changes. So because of that, sometimes the sun is a little ahead of where our clocks say at noon. And sometimes it reaches noon, the meridian, a little behind schedule. And that accounts for the left-right bit in the equinox.
Okay.
Also, our tilt helps account for that because, as Ray and I were talking about before, at the time of the solstices, there's not much change in the sun's position relative to time, whereas right now there's a big change. That also helps account for that width of the analemma. All right, now we're set up for earliest sunrise and earliest sunset. Since we're not going to spend too much time about it, let's just consider earliest sunset. Picture that analemma now moving as the day goes on, just like the sun does, heading toward the west. Now, when the date that you're going to get the earliest sunset is not the bottom of the analemma, that is December 21st, where the sun is at the southernmost point, the bottommost point, it's where the bottom rightmost point hits the horizon. In other words, it's the first possible time that that analemma, figure 8, hits the horizon as it moves. And that date turns out to be December 7th, not December 21st.
Mm. Okay.
And so that accounts for that unevenness. We've given you a lot of time on this.
Yeah, I hope
is
you're
this
satisfied.
More is this more satisfying than last time?
Well,
no, come on, just say yes.
Not really, because I still say there's a geometric factor here.
All right. Well, we can't give any more time.
Well, I tell you what, Reed. We'll try to pick this up next time. In the meantime, my brain hurts, and we're just going to move on. Yeah. D in Selkirk. D, you're on. Hello, D. Hello, D in Selkirk. Let's hit the button.
The analemma drove them away.
D, are you there? Goodbye. Let's go to Lee in Ulster. Lee.
Hi, I must say that last one might have worked better with graphs.
I know. I wish this was television, or I wish I was back teaching college and I had the chalkboard in front of me. And then you can do this whole thing in about 30 seconds.
Yeah, it'll work better with graphs or scotch. I mean, those are two other. All right, go ahead.
Mine's a more practical question. I was wondering if there was anything for, considering the focus that's now being put on these bodies that are coming towards us, is there anything for backyard astronomers to find? Is there something out there still for folks who are setting up their telescope in the backyard that are going to find something that hasn't been seen before.
Absolutely. For example, Rob McNaught. That was his name, who's found 76 comets. Although he's used professional equipment, he's just a person, not a automated comet or asteroid seeking a bit of computer-guided equipment, which is how many are discovered. And you have people like David Levy, who has found several comets. And it's estimated that any dedicated amateur who sweeps in the right place, and the right place is usually in the direction of sunrise or sunset, but before it gets light or just after it gets dark, and then sees a little blur, a little blob, and then has a good star atlas to see that it's not really a galaxy or a distant nebula, you can still be the first. The average is about 1,400 hours of effort before you find a comet.
Wow, that's not bad.
But if you do, it's the last celestial object that gets named after you. You could find a new star, new galaxy, new nebula, and it doesn't bear your name, but find a new comet, and should it brighten and become an object on everyone's lips, your name will be emblazoned across the heavens.
So Comet Lee from Ulster will be
Yeah, thank you, guys. Thanks
a lot.
For the show.
Sure.
Now, the asteroid that had a near pass a month or two ago, that was actually discovered by just a guy, right?
Exactly, 2012 DA14. And that was discovered only a year earlier by an individual. Unfortunately, individuals don't get asteroids named after them.
No.
They're named by the year and then by a letter and number designation. So too bad for him. It was an asteroid, not a comet.
All right, let's go to, is it Helena in West Hurley?
That's correct.
How are you?
I'm wonderful today. Several nights ago, we had a clear night, and I looked in the southwest sky, and I saw some very bright stars or planets near the moon. It wasn't in the new moon. It was about maybe a quarter.
Yeah, it was beautiful. I noticed that. That was Jupiter next to it.
Oh, it was Jupiter.
Yep.
Was there another one floating around there?
Well, it was Jupiter right next to the moon, the brighter of the two, and the orange star Aldebaran was nearby also.
Oh, okay. Very
so it was
good.
A three-way conjunction. I happened to be out walking my so-called dog.
What do you mean your so-called dog?
Well, it's a little tiny thing. You know, this is the kind of animal that as soon as you see this with a big guy, you say to yourself, some woman was involved.
All
there,
right. All right. Okay. We apologize, Helen, for that.
I've come to love this. I've come to love Walnut. So I was walking Walnut and I looked up, and there, oh, it was gorgeous. So
wasn't it gorgeous? It was just a little bit of luck. I just happened to be out, and I just, wow.
It was very
seeing?
Nearly the half moon, and there was Jupiter right next to it, and there was Aldebaran, just a little less dim, but only slightly further away, the brightest star in Taurus.
Thank you, Helen. I appreciate it.
Got a quick question about our, is it Venus? It's no longer floating around in the early morning star
anymore?
Yeah,
it's behind the sun now. It's
behind the sun. Ah, shucks. Oh, well, is there anything else we should be looking for early morning?
Well, Saturn is coming back in another just another month. It's going to be at its closest to us. But Saturn, to see the glory, really requires a fairly good telescope, unlike Jupiter, which, as you saw, was just beautiful by itself.
Yes, it was. Thank you so very much. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much. Yes, I can't get over the fact that you have a dog named Walnut. We'll talk about that off the air. Robert in Poughkeepsie, you're on. Robert.
Yes, hi. I have a question. At the beginning of the show, you said today the sun rises due east.
Yes.
And I assume it'll set due west.
Yes.
And I just have some trouble understanding that. If it's directly over the equator, why don't we have to look towards the equator?
Well, you know, you're right. You'd have to look towards the equator when it's at its highest point at 1 p.m., and then you'd be looking in the direction of the equator to see it because at that point.
But not when it rises and sets?
No, because the direction that we are rotating, which is our planet is rotating west to east, means that when you first glimpse the sun, it's going to clear the horizon in the direction that Earth is rotating toward. And it can be, as we all know, the sun can rise a little north of east or south of east, depending on our tilt at that time of the year. But because right now that tilt is perpendicular to the sun, the direction of the sunrise is exactly east. In fact, that's one more sign that the sun is over the equator, because that's at that moment, if you look toward the sun at that moment, you are looking in the right direction to see it. So
That would be the same. That's the same everywhere in the world, then.
Exactly so. Yes, yes. Only at the equator is there 12 hours of day and 12 hours of night all the time throughout the year.
Right.
But right now they're sharing that with the whole rest of the world. No matter where in the world you live, you get 12 and 12. And a little asterisk next to that is that thanks to our thick atmosphere, the air is 14 times thicker at the horizon than it is high overhead. So that bends the sun's image upward by its own width. So actually when the sun is really should be half buried beneath the horizon, it's actually pushed up so that we see a full sun.
Huh.
And this gives us an extra about 5 minutes of undeserved sunshine today on the equinox. And so days and nights are precisely balanced. In fact, it adds up during the year. Here's an interesting fact. This 40 extra hours of sun then darkness during the year, because those little daily extra bits of sun we get because of that refraction adds up. So day and night are an even balance if you add up the hours and ignore twilight. Of course, twilight adds some more light, but it's not even close to a 50-50 mix during the year. We have more sun than darkness.
So, Robert, thanks for the call. So when they say the sun will rise at blank, are they calculating it based on that extra little bit we get from...
Yep, that's factored in.
Very interesting. All right, Zach, let's take a break. We'll get back to Bob Berman in a moment. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. More Vox Pop, the home stretch, coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from Smith College Museum of Art, presenting Collecting Art of Asia, a four-part exhibition celebrating 100 years of Asian art at Smith, from traditional to contemporary, now on view, smith.edu/artmuseum. The Honest White Food Co-op in Albany, offering local and organic produce, natural groceries, artisan cheeses, and more, honestwhite.coop. Veterinary Emergency and Specialty Hospital, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, providing ophthalmology, surgery, and internal medicine services for dogs and cats, now offering laser eye surgery, VESHDeerfield.com. And 10,000 Villages in Stuyvesant Plaza, Albany, and on Main Street in Northampton, featuring fairly traded home decor and gifts handcrafted by artisans around the world, 10,000villages.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Bob Berman is our guest, and back to the phones we go. It's Dee in Selkirk. Dee, did you try to get through before?
I did.
What happened?
I think I lost John myself.
All right, well, you are back. You're on.
Okay. Well, thanks for taking my call. An old farmer friend of mine used to say the rainbow colors that are vertical in the sky on each side of the sun were called sun dogs, and they could tell that a storm was off 7 to 14 days out. How true is that, and what are they actually called?
Sun dogs are the real term, especially
really?
When the sun is lowish in the sky. We're talking about maybe 20 degrees up, about a quarter of the way up the sky, third of the way up the sky. If you see a bright spot, 22 degrees right or left of the sun, and forget about degrees. Here's how you can tell where a sun dog is. If you extend your arm fully, close one eye,
okay,
and stretch your thumb and your pinky as far apart as possible and put, let's say, the thumb on the sun, the pinky will show you the position of the sun dog. That'll show you 22 degrees.
Wow.
It works for everybody, because if you have a longer arm, you usually have a bigger hand that goes with it that'll still measure out 22 degrees, and it's called a sun dog.
A sun dog is exactly what?
The scientific name is a parhelion.
Okay.
And so parhelia are common. We get them two or three times a week here. So people who don't see them just really aren't looking. And now for that other part, does it really predict the weather? Sun dogs can either be white, almost as if they're miniature suns. They can be brilliant, or they can be just full of colors.
Wonderful.
Either way. And since they're caused by ice crystals, six-sided ice crystals, they're high cirrus clouds. And high cirrus clouds are indeed the first phase that comes over us before we get the lower mid-level and then the lower clouds indicating a storm. The only thing that was wrong about what your friend said, it's not 14 days.
No.
It would be more like 8 hours, 10 hours, maybe 14 hours before a storm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we see the same thing, and I know even from being a kid around these parts, you know, on a cold winter night, if you see a big ring around the moon, you can lay some money down. There'll be some snow soon.
Right. Same thing. Same really type of phenomenon. That's and that's the same distance, by the way, from the moon or the sun. 22 degrees. Same thing. Stretched out hand at arm's length, and you get that ring or halo.
Yeah.
With red on the inside, even in the moon, with the moon, you can often see the red, and around the sun, certainly. And then usually outside of that, the colors kind of fade just to white, though.
Huh. Okay. Hey,
well, thank you so much.
Thanks for sticking with us and getting through finally. Let's go to George in New Lebanon. George, you're on with Bob Berman.
Oh, hello. Hey, Ray.
Hey.
Hey, I have a question. I've heard that there's an oscillation of the North Pole within like a 26,000-year period, forward and backward. Is that true?
Hang on. He's taking his coat off.
Yes, yes.
This is the casual portion of the program.
I'm in the hot seat to verify that. Yes, it's 25,780 years. To be exact, but you said 26,000. You know, I'd give you full credit for that. And that oscillation is because the Earth, we not only spin, of course, once a day, or to be exact, once every 23 hours, 56 minutes, but in addition to that, like a top, you know, like a child's top or a gyroscope, in addition to spinning, as it's kind of dying down, it'll sometimes make a wobble.
Yeah.
It's spinning, but it's wobbling. So we wobble once every 26,000 years. And so the place at our axis points isn't always Polaris. It traces out a circle in the sky. In fact, we just did that in a planetarium show in Anchorage just a few days ago, and I pointed that out to our people. So gradually the North Star has changed. This is the best one we've ever had, because in terms of being bright and being at the actual spot in the sky that doesn't seem to move as the night goes on, Polaris is great. But we've had others like Thuban, where the pyramids passageways point, and that was 5,000 years ago. We had Kokhabit around the time of Christ. There's been other North Stars.
Okay, what's the next one?
Okay.
We're not going to have a bright one for a while. Deneb and then Vega, but they'll be brighter than the present one, but not as close to the point of true north.
All right. Your next question, George?
Okay. I'd like to point something out. There is no such thing as science fiction, only science foresight. Jules Verne conceived the time machine, the three-stage rocket ship to the moon, a nuclear submarine, farming the ocean. None of those things came true because the technology was not available.
Yeah, right.
So keep in mind that living on other planets, living in space, can be entirely possible.
I think you make a point.
We don't have the technology for it. We have a concept.
Mm-hmm.
But the things we're living now are concepts. The Nautilus, excuse me.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So anyway.
We're losing you. I think we're losing the
But your point is well made, George, and thank you for calling. So you were speaking of the 26,000-year cycle. That's the physical North Pole, not the magnetic North, which also moves, right?
Yeah, the magnetic poles move. Those are moving rapidly. They're moving 35 miles a year.
Right.
Where compasses point.
And so that's okay, right?
That's okay.
We won't die when that happens.
No, it almost doesn't matter where compasses point. You know, as long as we have a magnetic field, does it really matter? I mean, the places a certain distance from each pole get nice auroras, and that's nice to have. But other than that, it doesn't affect the health of the planet where they're located.
Okay, let's go to Edward in North Adams. Edward, you're on.
Hey, I'd like to know if you know of any calculations that could tell me, if I were to stabilize myself in a point in space right now where I am, and how far I am from an equally stabilized point from the point in space I was born, and tell me how many miles I am away from that point.
Huh? Now, by stabilized point, when you say stabilized, I'm thinking of gravitationally balanced point, for example, where the Earth and the Sun's gravity balances, where if you place something, it would sort of stay there?
No. I'm saying if I could make myself stay where I was born, and right at that point in space, and not move with the Earth, not move with anything, not move with the Sun, not move with the galaxy, just stay right at that point. And then take another fixed point right now. how far am I away from the point I was born at?
Okay, well, you know, that's a reasonable thing, like in the old days of sailing ships where they'd throw dye or barrels or people they didn't like overboard.
Yeah, no,
and then they count how much time before the object would be drifting back. Of course, space without objects to define it is meaningless. There is no grid system in space. But, you know, I'm not going to beat around the bush. I understand exactly what you're saying. Let's pretend that there really was a grid system and we could go back in time to the moment you were born. Well, here's what's happened. Of course, we're going around the sun, but we do that over and over and over again, and we return to the same spot relative to the sun on your birthday every year. So that's an easy one.
Okay.
But the real change for the caller is that the sun, carrying Earth along with it for the ride, is moving at 144 miles a second around the center of the galaxy. So what
that's
you
about how fast I can run, Bob.
Nice.
So what you have to do to get back to the starting point where you were born is calculate how many seconds since you were born, multiply by 144, and that's how many miles backward in our galactic spin. We're 25,000 light years from the center, so maintain that equal distance because our orbit is somewhat roundish. Head backwards the way right now we're heading toward the star Deneb. That's the direction we're going. So find the antipodal spot in the sky from Deneb. Head that way. 144 miles per second times the number of seconds since your birth, and that's the spot in which you were born.
Huh.
Excellent.
But the galaxies are also moving, right?
I just want to let you know I've got my spaceship ready, and as soon as I got the thing, I'm heading back there, and I'm going to watch myself get born.
Well, terrific. You
of
know,
course, the time of your birth is less important than the time of conception, so I'd go back another 9 months.
All right. Well, you know, this is terrific.
Oh, okay.
And let's move on. Thank you very much for the call, and wow, the show got away from me early today. It's really, all right. George in Pittsfield. George, you're on with Bob Berman.
Hi. First, I want to say I really enjoy the show with Bob on every chance I get to listen to it.
Yeah, he's a lot of fun.
Thank you. But since we're talking about the sun and we're posing weird questions today,
yes.
My weird question for Bob is, can you give us an explanation of the phenomenon that's commonly called the green flash
that
occurs at sunset and sunrise under certain conditions.
Yep.
And the second part of that is what's the best conditions to observe that?
Okay. Oh, I love this.
Well, I've looked for the green flash at every opportunity, which is seeing a flat horizon at sea. That's the best way. I've looked for it maybe 250 times. I've seen it almost 20 times.
Mm-hmm.
So if my experience is typical, maybe one time out of 11, you'll see it.
Okay.
And it's not really a flash. Having said that, one time it actually was a flash. But what happens is that because of refraction, and you know the sun is composed of all the rainbow colors, in the thick horizon air, each sun is slightly displaced from the other. That is, the red sun sets first, and then right after that, an orange sun, a yellow sun, a green sun, and then the blue image of the sun, and they're all overlapped. So if there's only a little bit of extra color sticking out from one to the other, the blue sun would set last. So in theory, the tip of the topmost sun would be blue, but there's no blue light left at sunset because of all the scattering that goes on to produce all those colors. So in practice, the topmost sun is a green sun. Now, you'll see what you see is the normal sun is setting. All that's left is like one spot of orange now. You know, the orange sun looks orange.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that's just that speck, that last speck of orange sun suddenly turns vividly emerald green just for a second or two, and then it vanishes below the horizon. And once in Egypt in 2006, I was telling everybody through the microphone on the tour bus, we were watching the sunset over the desert, and I was saying everybody should look for the green flash, and there it was vividly. But you know what? About a third of the bus didn't see it. They were all looking, and the people said, I didn't see it.
Colorblind, perhaps?
I don't know if it's that so much as people are expecting something maybe more vivid or in your face, or maybe that it'll flash brighter, when it's usually just a subtle changing of orange to
green.
Yeah,
I've seen it twice in my life.
Hey, and, there we go.
Once from an airplane.
Right.
With a very sharp horizon.
Right. I've seen it from then it can really last long from an airplane.
Yes. It was probably on the order of a couple of seconds.
Yes.
And most people that I talk about the green flash to look at me like I'm crazy, so I appreciate you validating.
No, absolutely. And once on a cruise ship, you know, there was a time when we could look at sunsets and they'd be purposeless. And now we have a purpose. We want to look for the green flash. And I was warning everybody, don't expect a flash. It doesn't get any brighter. And darn it, that one time, that little last bit of orange not only turned green, but got much brighter.
Wow.
I'd never seen that before. So that actually was a green flash. I didn't think such a thing existed. But
yes, it's impressive when you see it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks a lot, George. We appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. It's Bob Berman and Ed in Salt Point. Ed, you're on.
Yes,
Edward, I'm sorry. It's Edward. Hi, how are you?
With the more or less, I guess, confirmation of the Higgs boson, I want to go to small scale here and just ask, can we anticipate that that discovery or something similar would have material effects on what you know, astronomy does, or are we talking about effects which would only relate to the Big Bang?
Yeah, I'd say so. What the last thing you said. Now, you know, I'm not a particle physicist, but it's interesting the theories of how the particle zoo fits together, what you know, our current understanding of quarks and leptons, and the big puzzle was why objects should have the mass they do. It always seemed arbitrary. Why should some quarks have low mass, some quarks have high mass? It just seemed scattershot. So the theory is that there is one particle, a boson, that endows. It's just presence endows other particles with their mass.
Yeah.
It determines the mass of particles. And it was a very lovely idea, and mathematically it should have worked. So finding that it actually is real, as they've appeared to have done, is a nice confirmation that we have a good handle on that. And Lord knows we need some of those, because we've been heading in the opposite direction in so many areas with the infinite universe and cosmology, where we found more and more things we don't know.
Yeah.
Dark energy, is the universe infinite, and where it seems as if the hallway is receding as we're walking down it, like in those dreams where you can never reach the other side. So it's great to have some areas where there's tangible progress in our intellectual or scientific understanding, and this is one of those. So, you know, good for them.
Edward, thanks a lot for the call. We go to Tom in, where are you, Pelican? Where are you calling from?
Calicoon, New York.
Oh, Calicoon. Okay, it says Pelican up there, but wherever you're calling from, you're on, and you have about 2 minutes.
Okay, I'm calling about a phenomena of a glow on the horizon at night. I'm not talking about in the west, you know, the afterglow of the sun, or I'm not talking about, you know, a rainy night when we have very low clouds and I can see the lights of a convenience store 10 miles away. It's on clear nights or nights with very high clouds in the east, and it's in the southeast, and that on the horizon it looks much brighter than the rest of the horizon of the sky, and I'm thinking that's the direction of New York City is about 100 miles away as the crow flies, and I'm at maybe 1,200 feet.
All right.
I don't know. What do you think?
Well, you know, when you first started talking about that, I thought you were talking about the zodiacal light, which is a phenomenon best seen at this time of year. There are countless dust particles in the plane of the solar system. And the way we're aligned at this time of year, at the correct time of night, which is not the middle of the night, but towards the ends of the night, the zodiacal light is a cone-shaped glow that's thick on the bottom, and then gets thinner and thinner, higher and higher.
Yeah.
And it almost looks like a dawn is coming, but it has nothing to do with dusk or dawn. In fact, Khalil Gibran wrote that, called it the, no, it was Omar Khayyam, called it the false dawn.
Uh-huh.
The false dawn.
I see.
And so it's very exciting to see that. And at first I thought maybe you were talking about that.
Well,
were you seeing it, let's say, 2 hours after sunset, or was it later than that?
Probably later than that.
Okay, well, in that case, and then you did mention high clouds, and that made me cross it mentally off the list, because the zodiacalite really requires perfectly clear skies. With high thin clouds, I think you've got the answer there.
Yeah.
I think if it was in the direction of New York City, high cirrus clouds could certainly reflect the lights of the city to that kind of distance readily. So
Tom,
I think you answered your own question.
We're out of time, buddy, but we appreciate the call, and thanks to Bob. You know, Bob, if I can find it, somewhere in my house I have this Handbook of Unusual Natural Phenomena by William Corliss. Have you ever seen this? You know, it catalogs, going way back, multiple suns and sun dogs and some of these atmospheric phenomena. It's a great book if you ever get your hands on it. William Corliss, a scientific thing.
I'll look for it. That sounds right up my alley.
And we'll see you next time. And thanks to everybody who called in today. Support comes from Subsidium Technologies, offering custom cloud connectivity, communications, and collaboration network services to clients globally. SubsidiumTech.com. Vision XL Eye Care, Lake Katrine, New York, providing eye exams, eye care, dry eye therapy, and more. Where eyewear is an art, Facebook or visionxleyecare.com. And the Unitarian Universalist Congregations, with locations in the Capital Region and beyond, teaching children and adults how to make a difference through social action and volunteerism, capitalregionuu.org. That's it for today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who handled the controls. Colleen O'Connell answered the phones. Tom Jobe assisted with our website and social media questions. Our producer, Patrick Donges. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, wow, first it's Bob Berman, then tomorrow it's the Science Forum. It's an embarrassment of riches. Stay tuned for a news update.